Freak Flags Fly every week on the Freak Power Ticket, a music and cultural arts program featuring interviews, themed playlists, and live in-studio performances. It all happens right here on KCSB FM 91.9, streaming live at www.kcsb.org, Mondays from 11 a.m. till 12 noon in Santa Barbara.
This is my happening, and it freaks me out.
It's Monday, time to let your freak flags fly. This is the Freak Power Ticket. My name is Ted Coe, and I'm very excited today to be greeting improvisational music legend Eugene Chadbourne, who just played a show last night at the Fun Zone here in Santa Barbara. My guest co-host, or host today, is David Novak, UCSB professor of music, an ethnomusicologist who helped bring Mr. Chadbourne here to Santa Barbara under the auspices of the Center for Interdisciplinary Study of Music. And Eugene Chadbourne is a legendary musician, radio host, writer, and more. We're going to listen to a song that I quite admire to open the show, and then we'll be getting set up before an interview and a playlist of Chadbourne-related music. We're going to open with a track called The Old Piano. You're listening to the Freak Power Ticket, KCSB FM 91.9 in Santa Barbara. Stay tuned.
Strings are right. dusty. He's mildewed to gray on the old piano. Nobody can Star-Spangled Banner, nobody can sing. These old voices can't prove a thing. The old cracked Liberty Bell no longer rings. Rusty, keys me due to gray on the old piano. Nobody can play.
All right. You're listening to KCSB FM 91.9 in Santa Barbara. This is the Freak Power Ticket, and we're about to get started. And I'm really excited to be greeting Professor Dave Novak, who will be guiding us through the next hour with musical great Eugene Chadbourne. And thanks to both of you for coming in this morning.
You're thanks, welcome.
Dad. Can't even see you. I'll stand up at some point. Yeah, yeah. Oh, and we have the banjo out too. Great.
Yeah.
Well, we wanted to get some music going on in the next few, but first we're going to... can you hear me okay? Yeah, good. Well, first, I want to say thanks to Eugene for being here, and it's a real treat for me personally because I've been listening to music since I was 16 or 17.
Wow.
And yeah, so that's been a while. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I love to, it was great for me to hear that you're going to be coming through town and that we were going to be able to make something happen. I knew we were going to be able to make something happen because when you're around, you know, these things sort of are able to happen. And I was mentioning to you earlier that the last time that I saw you, it was it was a concert that was organized by someone I didn't know, and they had signs up around town that said, come into Fort Tryon. I was living in Manhattan in New York, and go down this path and take a left and take a right and take a left and take a right, and you'll see a rock, and that's where Eugene Chadbourne's going to be playing. So I said, this is never going to happen.
The ultimate rock concert.
Yeah. So, so I took the subway up there, to Fort Tryon in the north, and I got out and I started walking. I took a left and I took a right and I took a left and I took a right, and I found the rock, and there you were. And there were 30 people sitting at the base of the rock listening to you play. And it was this incredible concert. It was one of the best things I ever saw. And, that was the last time I saw you, and then last night at the Fun Zone. So, really it's great to know that you're out there doing these things that other people, might not have the creativity to find themselves in that place. And, you've been doing that for such a long time. And one of the first times I encountered you was through your book, which was your first book. I guess you have more than one book, more than two.
Well,
I hate the man who runs this.
There's a couple things that they're called chap books that universities publish. They're not like full out books, but that one you're talking about was the one published by Mix Books. Mm-hmm. It's like a music business reference book.
It really was like one of these books at the time. I think there was very little for independent musicians to just know how they could survive or live in a world where, you didn't know how to network, you didn't know how to find gigs, you didn't know how to get paid, and the book really told people those kinds of things.
Well, there was a lot of crap coming out around the time. Mm-hmm. The publisher came to me, somebody working with the publisher, and they showed me this book, How to Book Your Own Tour or something like this, and they said, what do you think about this? And I looked through it, and I said, well, the person's never left their telephone. They really don't know what they're talking about. So I said, we felt the same when we wanted a professional musician to write about the life, And I said, well, how much censorship is there going to be? Oh, it was a very interesting thing to be involved with something like that.
Uh-huh. And so, when you started talking about this, the music industry, in some ways, things haven't changed at all. But there was the touring network that, might have been sort of more robust in the 90s or the later 80s. I think, when did the book come out, in the mid-80s?
No, it was well after that.
Well after that? Okay.
It must have been maybe the... all I know is I was editing the... I was proofreading it, mm-hmm, when they were shooting that movie Scream 2 in Atlanta. Huh. We were in the same hotel with the crew.
Okay.
So, I'm really bad with dates. Yeah. But the point of the book to me was to tell people, if you're going to be a musician, you've got to love playing music. Mm-hmm. You've got to find some kind of music you really love. You have to like it. Don't worry about the guy on the side of the room talking to his girlfriend, whether he likes it or not. Worry about that later. First, you have to really like it. You have to really love it. And then you'll enjoy doing it. Mm-hmm. And if you enjoy doing it, people will hear that, and then they'll really like it. Yeah. And then something you do 50 years ago, somebody's going to want to listen to it 50 years later. Mm-hmm. But you really have to work on it. You have to make it something you really like, and there has to be some substance to it. And that was really the whole point of the book.
Right.
And then, there was a lot of different things about touring and blah, 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 and booking.
But it helps.
But
because,
what the funny thing to me was how many people wrote me about, I really love this book. But isn't there something I can do, so I don't have to go on tour for 30 years? Isn't there some way I can write a really good song after only playing for 2 years? Is there some little thing, they all thought there was some little thing I left out that was going to, mm-hmm, funny, huh?
Yeah. Well, for me at the time, I felt like I knew what I wanted to do as a musician, and then there was this, here's how you get money out of someone who's not going to pay you.
Well, that's there, yeah. All this kind of stuff is important, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were just over at your office talking about Rough Trade Records, but that the first thing I really learned in that experience was that... the guy that produced the tape was just excited the tape was coming out. And I was trying to figure out, there's got to be some money in this. And if I'm doing this and spending the day painting houses or something because I'm not getting any money, then maybe I don't even want to put a record out. To hell with it, But I knew right away they had to pay me for the original songs up front. It was England. And I realized... I was taken to the accountant's office, and the accountant said to me, I'm the only person here of any importance. And I realized, yeah, whoever is writing the checks or is in charge of the check ledger is really important in this kind of situation. So you're kind of learning all these things as you go along.
Yeah. Well, let me back up for those who might be tuning in or who don't know Eugene Chadbourne. Maybe we can talk a little bit about how long you've been doing this. A lot of people might not know that. And, you know, you've how many records you've actually put out, which is an incredible and stunning amount of things. And when I say records, I'm not just talking about records. I'm talking about cassettes. I'm talking about CDs, you know, one-offs, all sorts of different things. And then things that have a fairly, you know, high profile as well. You know, so all sorts of different things. And it's a really unique model of how to be a musician and how to be in the business. So I don't know. Do you want to give... I don't want to speak for you.
That was pretty good. Well, I produced my first record of solo guitar music in 1975.
Okay.
But even prior to that, one really funny memory that I enjoy was these couple friends in high school had these things they were selling at the time that were 8-track recorders. So you could make one copy at a time of and we made these live recordings of my original songs that I was writing in high school.
Yeah.
And we liked the way the 8-track would click from track to track. You were supposed to program it so there was a space, but if you didn't, it would just click right in. So I was working that into songs and stuff. And I remember we made this recording one night, and this one friend had it, and we were riding around. Of course, then what you do is you take these girls and you drive around in cars and stuff, and that's we're doing that in Boulder and in Great Falls, Montana, and these. So this guy is like, where did you get this? Are they playing your music on the radio? I said, no, we made this 8-track. I want one. So, but then we had to re-record all the songs for this guy. So it was like every weekend I was recording all the songs for all these different friends. We had to make a new copy for each person. So that might have been the beginning of my recording career.
Yeah, and that's an incredible moment because it really shows you how difficult it was to imagine yourself on a recording at that time, you know, that you would go through that kind of a process, and it probably never occurred to you, you know, how you could, I mean, it really was inaccessible to press a recording.
But it's funny, if you're a certain generation, lots of people owned reel-to-reel machines. It was part of the kind of stereo hi-fi setup, if you were middle class.
Right.
And so, like my wife, for instance, she had the same experience with her sisters messing around with tape recorders at home, even though they weren't musicians. And that's, you know, we did that, like, we would spend the whole night, stay up all night playing guitars into these things and speeding them up and just messing around. So this is the beginning of it, I guess, too.
Yeah, so it's like a mix of experimentation with the tape recorder and using it as a distribution machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then when did you start sort of going out and trying to find people who would, you know, put the music out? Or did you, what was it like in 1975 to think about, okay, I've got this solo, you know, guitar recording, what am I going to do with it?
Well, I got a lot of it, you know, particularly I got a lot of encouragement from Anthony Braxton, and he was just such a hero to me that, and, you know, there I was in Calgary with everybody talking behind my back about this guy put out a record and he doesn't even know how to tune his guitar and all this and what an idiot. And so along comes this guy's master musician. He says, oh, I heard a recording of your solo concert and it's fabulous and you'll be one of the innovators of the guitar. You've got to establish your reputation in this immediately in this period. You've got to put out a recording. Don't send it to record labels. They don't know what's happening. You put it out yourself. And that's what he did with his solo saxophone record. I remember that he told the guy, I'm going to put it out myself unless you put it out. And Del Mar ended up putting it out. Mm-hmm. But Leo Smith had his own label at that point. A lot of my heroes had started their own record labels, including the Beatles at one point.
Right.
It was just something, to me, it was like, why not do it? I had the money. It was such a great experience to do that, you know, and just documenting the music is so much fun.
Yeah.
There's so many funny things about it. I really like going into a place and something will be on and I'm like, that guy has an interesting style. Well, it plays a little like me, and then that's you. That is you. But I made so many recordings I don't even recognize them all anymore. Well, some people really have trouble committing to something, a recording and releasing it, and, you know, maybe I'm too casual about it. I don't know.
So this was really like the free improvisation, free jazz world. world that you were a part of in the mid 70s?
The recordings I did in the guitar music was really influenced by Braxton's whole approach to solo saxophone music, mm-hmm. which was like to take certain elements and make pieces about them. Uh-huh. So that's how I started with that. Right away, of course, there was a dichotomy. Solo saxophone music was like an aberration.
Right.
Solo guitar music is the most normal thing in the world. You can't even walk down a street without seeing some clown on the corner playing Hey Joe or something. Yeah. So, okay, that's an interesting thing. But then the type of music I was doing was really different. But at the same time, you could find classical guitar music, avant-garde classical guitar music. So there were all these different – I also felt I was part of the continuum of music that had excited me as a teenager, folk country blues and mm-hmm. slide blues and all this stuff I started playing that I already knew how to play. So I kept kind of feeling like, well, I'm really on the edge of it, but then maybe I'm really traditional, and it kind of kept going back and forth. And I stopped singing for a long time. I was just doing instrumental music,
uh-huh.
you know.
And the country western stuff came back in the 80s, or?
That was right around the early 80s. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of different elements happened. I mean, it was the improvisers I was working with, we were mixing in lots of little bits of different types of music. Mm-hmm. We felt that they could be understood as sound mm-hmm. as well as music, a kind of a sound texture. Mm-hmm. With John Zorn primarily, it was bebop we were throwing in little bits of. Uh-huh. But when I went on the road with Toshinori Kondo, mm-hmm. We were also using real handheld radio mic, these little cheap microphones, and I was playing with electric guitar and a lot of contact microphones on different things, and I ended up doing some lyrics. I was singing into this contact microphone while playing electric guitar, and I think he was smashing some tin cans on the ground or something. We were making this din in this radio station, and I just was trying to think of some lyrics to sing. Now, I'm not good at all at just improvising lyrics while I'm playing. Uh-huh. So I just started I thought, what was one of the first songs I learned on guitar? And I skipped over the first one, which was Stepping Out, but I remembered one called I just remember the first lyric was, I had to leave town because of Uncle Sam's deal. I guess my good loving done lost. It's called Stepping Out by Paul Revere and the Raiders. The first one I actually learned was the Stepping Stone, because it only has three notes. Uh-huh. That's a good one to start on rock guitar. Uh-huh. So I did the vocal part of that. And that was the first cover song I'd done in this, or like a little bit of one coming out of this free improvised music. And we started doing more and more longer. These bits got longer because there was also it's a kind of a cliche if the excerpts from things are always short. Mm-hmm. So we're always kind of tinkering with this weird structure of this stuff we were creating. And then we started doing longer versions of this stuff. Coincidentally, around that time, every now and then I would take these weird jobs just to get money. One of them, I was playing up at a college, and they said they had a kind of a conference of retired people were hanging out on college for the week and doing different events, and they were having a little party, and they needed some music. And I was teaching nearby. They said, could you play something? I said, well, I could play jazz, some old jazz standards, you know, stuff I was practicing, Duke Ellington stuff. Oh, that'd be great. So I get up there and playing all these old Duke Ellington type songs, you know, Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Fine, you know, they were perfectly happy with that. And it's like you're getting paid to practice. And this guy comes up at the intermission. He says, why don't you do the vocals? And I said, well, I don't think I have a good voice. And he waved around at all the people, like, who cares with these people? Mm-hmm. He says, we don't care. Mm-hmm. We'd like to hear the vocals. The words mean something to us. Mm-hmm. And my girlfriend at the time, she said, what do you got to lose? You know, I said, yeah, it's not like some critic from Downbeat's going to be here. So that was the first night I sang. And then a couple people came up and said, you have a pretty nice voice. Now, I never heard that again for years. You know, one thing that's absolutely consistent is that anytime anybody that's known as an instrumentalist starts singing, they get these incredible reviews of how horrible they are. It's absolutely – but one of the ones that really – I really liked was from the heavy metal magazine, Kerrang. They said, I could be the greatest heavy metal guitar player in the world, but I ruined it all by singing like Bugs Bunny. And that to me was like, I don't care what happens. Now I've made it. I've been compared to Bugs Bunny.
All right. Well, you know, one of the things I want to eventually get to is you playing 50 Cent, because you mentioned that right before. I said, I got to hear that. That's okay. One of the things
we got that ready.
Do you want to do that now, or do you want to hear a recording now and then say
no,
that?
No, let's do this now.
Okay,
before
let's do this now.
We forget about this, and this is like, if I like a song, I learn it, and I learned this one off a TV show. And
what's it called?
It's the theme from the TV show Power.
All right. And you're listening to Eugene Chadbourne on KCSB 91.9.
They say this is a big rich town. I just come from the poorest part. Bright lights, big city. I gotta make it. And Santa Barbara's where it all goes down. I just happen to come apart. Legal or illegal, baby, I gotta make it. I never took a straight path nowhere. Life is full of twists and turns, bumps and bruises. I live and learn. I'm from such a big rich town, but from the poorest part, where it's so hard to get a start in these parts without a paper. I grew up in hell, a block away from heaven. Standing in the corner, 15 minutes, moving bags of snow, bag it up and watch it go. In a big rich town, I come from the poorest part. I'm an undercover liar. I lie under the covers. I look her in the eye and say, baby, I love you. You're my inspiration. You're the motivation. You're the reason I'm selling everything on the street with absolutely no hesitation in the big rich town. The poorest part. Bright lights, big city. I gotta make it. This is where it all goes down. I just happen to come apart.
This is KCSB FM 91.9 in Santa Barbara, the Freak Power Ticket, and we're back with Eugene Chadbourne and then UCSB Professor David Novak.
All right, that was terrific.
Thanks, I'm glad you liked it.
And you seem to be drawn to, you know, socio-political themes. Is that what brought you to 50 Cent's music, or was it the TV show that we were talking about before?
Well, it's kind of with the rap music, it's a long, funny process. I guess it kind of started when my daughters were not old enough to drive themselves places. It's kind of goes on for 2-3 years. You're actually in the car listening to Top 40 radio. Mm-hmm. You know, and in my case, what's interesting is they're saying, you should do a cover of this song, Dad. This would be good. And I got kind of interested in the idea of doing cover versions on the banjo, because I was doing cover versions of all kinds of different material on the banjo. I'd gone through a whole process of like taking the banjo out at places like punk clubs in Germany, where they look at it like, my God, it's a banjo. And they don't know what I'm going to play. So I was learning jazz songs, psychedelic songs, all kinds of different stuff. And I thought that is really a funny thing to do if you can do the rap music, mm-hmm. because it's the elephant in the room always in American society is the racial stuff with the music, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know any other way to describe it other than, well, if a white guy plays Sitting on Top of the World, it's country, old-time music. If a black guy, it's blues. I mean, it's like this weird stuff is going on all the time. So the very first one I did was by DMX, One More Road to Cross. Uh-huh. One of my kids was playing me the whole CD, driving her home from somewhere, and I said, you know, this is amazing. It has an electric guitar on it. I got all excited. And then there was another song on the radio with an electric guitar solo. Now, the other side of this is just going on is I'm pointing out these things to my kids, you know, like, hey, that's the first guitar solo I've heard on the radio in a year, uh-huh. And that was Usher. You Got It Bad. And I actually used to do a cover of that with the two or three girls singing. It was really fun. So we kind of we put this stuff together. The last time we did this 50 Cent song, they were working with me in the band, and we also did a medley of it with a song we used to do together by Mystical, uh-huh. The guy that just screams all the time. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but they sing, "Been so long, he's been on." Yeah, danger. Danger!
Right, right.
Dr. Chad is in the room. So we've had a lot of fun monkeying.
This is with your daughters?
We've had a lot of fun monkeying around with that stuff. It's funny music. It's funny how people are threatened by certain types of music that just – like my father. Well, that's another thing that got me really interested in rap music. I was kind of ignoring it completely, but I was on a bus with him in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And this guy got on with the radio, mm-hmm. and my dad's reaction to it, I was like, God, I haven't seen him get upset like that since I brought the Captain Beefheart record home.
And he said, this is good.
Well, I was like, there must be something there.
Yeah. I think that maybe the first record that I got was the Campervan Chadbourne record, and that record had on it sounds like Evil Filthy Preacher and mm-hmm. things like that, you know. And that these were the, you know, they might have been some of the most, you know, contemporary political songs that I was hearing at the time, and there was plenty of stuff.
Yeah.
But the lyrics are very clear, and, you know, there's a particular kind of quality to the things that you're talking about. So I wanted to talk about sort of the political songs that you write and, you know, that some of the things that you've put in your music. I don't know, maybe you, if you know, because you're saying it's maybe the electric guitar, but it can just be the electric guitar that brings you these songs.
It has nothing to do with the electric guitar. I mean, the first, I always would give credit to Phil Oakes, because I used to see him perform when I was a teenager. Uh-huh. And I remember one night in particular, I don't know what song he was doing, but he had a very interesting combination of sentimentality and humor. And there was a very moving song, and it was, you know, a time, you don't have to imagine people the way people feel now, the way people feel at that time with Vietnam going on and the civil rights stuff going on and all the stuff with the hippies and everything. I remember thinking, I want to do this. I want to have a song that makes people laugh about this stuff, so temporarily they feel a little better, mm-hmm. or it also really affects the way you feel when you're emotionally moved by something, like some of the songs that Phil Oakes did, White Boots, Marching in a Yellow Land, this type of thing, Knock on the Door. So was the reason that it kept coming back to me, writing lyrics, writing satirical lyrics, writing about political stuff. Of course, doing the improvised music with the scene when I started in Canada and in New York, it was instrumental music and it didn't make any reference to any politics at all. And when I made the first record with songs, it was called The President is Insane, that was produced by Michael Shepard in L.A., there was this – actually, I would overhear people go, Chadbourne's gone political. And then it was like suddenly it was the ideal time to do it because we had Ronald Reagan in the White House and the punk scene was really – there were some incredibly creative and great bands doing really great political music. And I was like – I wanted to be part of it. And there's no shortage of material all the time. And I still like to write political songs.
And the irony of you playing with this instrumental stuff in Canada is you were in Canada to get out of the
Vietnam War. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I always, you know, I think that playing music, just, you know, you, when you come down to it, being creative is a political act in this society, for sure. And then you have different types of music. It's like you're getting your own band and going out and doing your own music. I mean, it's a statement of some kind, you know. You could be a right-wing Christian rock group, but on the same time, on one level, you're kind of showing an independent spirit that's very important.
I wanted to ask about your book, because I know you have a new book out, Dreamery, and it's self-published, or is it? Did you?
Yeah, I decided to self-publish it after a couple of meetings with publishers, one of whom suggested I abandon the project and write a book about Bob Dylan's lyrics. So I thought, well,
there aren't enough books about that. Yeah.
Well, that was the whole point. They told me that every book that comes out about Bob Dylan, no matter what it is, immediately sells 5,000 copies or something. So anyway, I just decided it's that you could make a million recordings or something, but a book like this, you can't just do another one right away. So I wanted it to be exactly what I wanted it to be. And then I thought the only way to do that really is to just publish it myself. And I got the help of a really old friend, one of the guys from the Calgary scene, that had helped me put my first album out. He designed the book and helped me put it together. So
tell me about what's in it.
Well, over the years, I had been writing a lot of stuff. I mentioned these chapbooks that were published. One was about being a draft dodger. One was about my tours of East Germany. I had material I'd written for Forced Exposure magazine about the junior high days in Boulder. I had a whole selection of tour diaries I had published. And I had also been keeping track. I'd been keeping a diary of my dreams for years. So in the course of putting all this material together, I realized that it would be great to have a volume that had all the stuff I'd written all together. And since it was all kind of connected, that it was about my life, somehow finding a way to tie it all together. And then I started using this concept of the dreams. And then one of the art forms I'm really love is film. And some of my favorite filmmakers have always made use of dreams for purposes that tie in with my kind of creative aesthetic about economy and, you know, just dealing with weird situations. One is Louis Buñuel, for instance, started doing this when he was producing films really on the cheap in Mexico. And if they were short, like 4 minutes of screenplay or something, they would just make up a dream and put it in. And then the other one was Robert Altman. He would base entire films on dreams. Also, the Wes Craven, who just died recently, one of his best films, People Under the Stairs, he dreamt the entire story. So I've always had a real fascination with the... And I also, I'll dream sets of chord changes. I dream song lyrics. I dream compositions. I dreamt once I went to an underground cavern in a glacier and listened to a Captain Beefheart record that was never released. And I listened to the whole thing in the dream.
And then you woke up and had
I couldn't
yours,
remember
did you
any of it. No, I couldn't remember one line.
Have you ever woken up with a song and actually had it?
Yes. Yeah. But I, you know, and one of them I recorded, but I never, I stopped playing it. I thought it was too depressing, that particular song.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but some, yes, yeah, certainly some things are come that are totally useful.
Well, let's play one more recording. Do you want to do that? We're here on the Freak Power Ticket with Ted Coe. It's good that we talked about film. Ted's also a big film buff. I know he wants to.
If you have that out, that June Carter song.
Let's hear that June Carter song. What is it called?
Okay, this is called I Used to Be Somebody. We just recently came across this. We're huge June Carter Cash fans, and it's a song, kind of an autobiographical song, and I've been performing lately, and also we're using it to pay tribute to a lot of people that have passed away recently.
Okay.
Well, the place was New York City, and the hour was growing late. We walked the streets of Harlem to the Greenwich Village Gate. We were young and foolish, trying out for fame. He said, James Dean was his name. And I held the rose. He gave me for an hour. He wrote down the words while I picked the wildwood flower. Well, I used to be somebody, Lord. I used to have a friend. I'd like to be somebody again. I used to be somebody. Good Lord, where have I been? I ain't ever gonna see James Dean again. Well, I went with Elvis Presley to see Brando from afar. I sat with Kazan and Tennessee and did a streetcar named Desire. We laughed a lot, we danced a lot, we rocked away our fears. That was back in my rock and roll years. When I held the rose, he gave me for an hour. Elvis sang the song while I picked the wildwood flower. I used to be somebody, Lord, I used to have a friend. I'd like to be somebody again. I used to be somebody. Good Lord, where have I been? I ain't ever gonna see James Dean again. Somebody, Lord, I used to have a friend. I'd like to be somebody again. I used to be somebody. Good Lord, where have I been? I ain't ever gonna see Elvis Presley again. Well, I got the best woman. My children, they all love me. I might have done some things that are good enough for you to see. But sometimes if I'm feeling low, I swing back to my fears. I go back to my rock and roll years. When I held the rose, he gave me for an hour. Elvis sang the song while I picked the wildwood flower. Well, I used to be somebody, Lord, I used to have a friend. I'd like to be somebody again. I used to be somebody. Good Lord, where have I been? I ain't ever gonna see James Dean again. Ain't ever gonna see Elvis Presley again. Ain't ever gonna see Jimmy Carl Black again. I ain't ever gonna see my dad again. I ain't ever gonna see Wes Craven again. I ain't ever gonna see Sam Rivers again. I ain't ever gonna see Robert Harris again. I ain't ever gonna see my mother again.
That was Eugene Chadbourne doing June Carter Cash's I Used to Be Somebody, and we're back with Eugene Chadbourne in studio and Professor David Novak. Thanks, guys, for joining me today, and we got about 15 minutes left. Maybe great. A little more time.
Yeah, that was wonderful. Can you tell us, you said you were mentioning in the break why you chose that track or some of the things associated with that track.
Well, our families really, we adore June Carter Cash, and So I can't remember how they came up exactly, but we found out about this record where she'd now I remember I took a biography of Johnny Cash on vacation in Mexico. So I was talking about this record she made and how much trouble she had getting it released and everything, but it sounded really interesting, so we ended up getting a copy, and I got really drawn to this song. I liked the story and everything. And I've had some really funny experiences performing it. This is also something you don't always think about. But I used to be somebody, so it has a lot of different types of meanings, obviously. But I ended up – so I'm performing in Basel in Switzerland. And one of the things that happens sometimes over the years is that scenes really change. And in this particular city, at one point – there was such a big music scene at this, associated with this one particular venue called the Kulturwerk Kaserne. And that I remember, like somebody was saying, yeah, you played in 1991 with the band Trans Am, and there were 5,000 people there, right? So now if I go back to Basel, there, I think next year I might be playing in the State Theater, so I shouldn't mouth off too much. But most of the time there isn't really much anywhere to play, not just for me or anybody passing through. Lately, a guy that runs a very nice alternative record and bookstore has been presenting shows in his little space. So it's very nice and informal and kind of a small crowd. And so I get told the story about this show in Basel, and here I am now playing for this 15 or 20 people, and I used to be somebody. So it was a whole kind of extra meeting, a kind of a making fun of yourself that I like to do.
You're definitely still somebody here at the station. And we also really loved to see your show last night, The Fun Zone, and I want to give a shout out to Spencer for organizing that show, and to Azeem Ward and Rob McGill for playing with you. And one of the things about the Santa Barbara scene is that it always takes somebody to like make these things happen.
One
of the great things about this scene all over the world is that there usually is somebody there to make these things
happen.
Well,
you hope. I mean, the downside of it is you can have a city that has like a million people, and then somebody will go, God, I haven't played a gig there in 10 years. Well, since so-and-so left, nothing's happening. One person makes it all happen sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'm always really enjoy the fact that people are doing stuff like that and the different forms it takes. Now, this was particularly interesting to have a music venue attached to a batting cage. That was new.
Yeah, I think that is one of the big it's a very appealing, because, you know, you get the room's full if you get 30 or 40 people in there, but, you know, bands always like to play there. People enjoy it there, and one of the reasons is you have this odd experience. You get to go into the batting cage. I mean, I don't, because I felt the first time I went in there, I felt the vibrations through my hands the rest of the night, but you can, you know, have a couple swings and things like that, and it is a unique place.
I was scared.
Scared to go in and...
Well, yeah. I couldn't believe the saxophone player was doing it. I said, like I told the audience, if that was me, I would have broken my hand and the show would have been canceled. Right. I remember some clown taking me. It was a gig. I was killing time in Tuscaloosa, and the club owner said, I usually go over to the Nautilus in the afternoon and pick up a lot of girls there. I didn't know what he was talking about. And we end up at this place with these frightening exercise machines. Right? I'm like, what is this crap? So this is this stuff like that they used to have in gym class. I hate this stuff. So we're doing this. He says, oh, you like this, man. This is really good for you. You could use a little bit of toning up. So I'm working in there for a while. And that night, man, I couldn't even move. I was so sore. It was horrible. It was like, that was the worst show you've ever done. Well, thank you.
Yeah, I guess you've learned.
Mr. Nautilus.
You've learned what you can tolerate and not tolerate. You got to sleep on the train from San Luis Obispo to Portland, right?
So. Sleeping on trains is something I can do like a master. That's my kind of gymnastics. Mm-hmm.
So your next thing is San Luis Obispo, right? You're taking the train. We're going to dash out of here and take the Amtrak.
Yeah, I'm going to be playing up there this evening at the Steinberg Gallery or Steinberg.
Steinberg.
Yeah.
So anyone who's in the area who's hearing this, you know, can get a chance to see Eugene Chadbourne. And, you know, when's the last time you were in California? It's not often, is it?
Well, maybe. I don't remember exactly.
A couple years ago, maybe?
At least.
Quite a few.
Two, three.
So, and then you're on your way up to Portland.
I'll be in Portland, Seattle, back in San Francisco for the end of it, and then... go back home.
Now, how long does it take for you to set up a tour like that? Is it easy to do, or is it something that you know enough people now, or are you always reinventing the wheel when it comes to networking and touring?
I wouldn't call it easy. It's usually initiated by someone, some reason. In the case of something usually in the West Coast, once I get somebody contacts me, I usually say, let me check this time period, because usually by the end of any given year, I have a free ticket I can use. So that sets the ticket, the tour up on the good foot right from the beginning. There's very little expenses. And then just start working on, you know, it's just kind of detective work, looking for contacts. Sometimes it's pretty easy, and Sometimes I'm still booking shows as the tour goes on. Sometimes somebody says, hey, will you play the farmer's market tomorrow night?
Yeah.
You know, et cetera. If I'm free, I do it. I've went over and played at, you know, Uncle Joe's Pizza Parlor one night.
And I think you were saying before that, you know, you don't always, or you were saying, I don't know, facetiously, you don't like to play with other people. But
in fact,
of course, you're kidding, because you've got all these incredible collaborations and some of the, like I said, with Cameron Beethoven, with the Violent Femmes, and I could go on and on. You know, we were talking about Polly Bradfield and one of the people who's, you know, also just all sorts of different people. Is there anyone you're playing with these days? Like, are you doing collaborations?
I have a really nice duo going with the drummer Schroeder, and we're playing a lot in Europe, a program I call Music of My Youth, and we've been doing that a lot. I have a band I've been working on developing out of North Carolina with a drummer named from Winston-Salem, Aaron Backhelder, and with my daughters Molly and Lizzie are in the band. Lizzie playing banjo and singing, and Molly singing. And there's a loose, there's kind of a group of musicians that work with me. One guy that plays in the symphony and also plays mandolin, the French horn player, Dave Doyle. He's been on like dozens of my records, and he's usually involved in a lot of the stuff we're doing. There's various different oboe player, Carrie Shull, you know, so there's a kind of a group I'm working with there. And yeah, different collaborations come up. For instance, I'm one of the things I'm doing here is I'm working with a country band for the show in Seattle.
Oh, who's
for
that?
For a little program I put together, the Contraband Country Band.
All right. And so are you all going to do, you're going to do the Merle Haggard songs or?
I would have to remember the set list. I put it together. It's got quite a lot, some nice stuff, including a Donovan cover, the New Year's Resolution, which is something people don't get to hear that often. I know we're doing a couple cover songs by Dick Curless, who they suggested that. They like him. He's not as well-known country singer, but he has a very good song, A Wrinkled, Crinkled, Wadded Dollar Bill, or we're going to do that one. Yes, add some of my stuff. Old piano. Happy New Year.
Now, you know, one of the things about the music industry as it's settled over the last few decades is it has gotten very stiff and sort of genre focused. And you're, you know, one night you're playing a banjo, or one night you're playing with, you know, some free improvisation, the next night you're doing country music. Is that what kind of effect do you think that's had for you? And has it been really positive in the sense of networking or going out? Has it also been limiting or?
Well, it's really what I like to do because of all the different styles. And then, you know, not some musicians just like to play one style. Yeah. You know, I respect everybody that's a musician. Some people like to get involved in different types of things. Drummers in particular, the ones I work with, they seem to like to the set list where there's a lot, some different feels and different styles they're playing, and it doesn't get boring. That's a kind of I'm looking for people to play with and do things all the time. But sometimes when someone asks me about how did you get to this weird combination of music, I'm like, well, when I was a kid, you couldn't avoid it. They didn't separate all the genres. We heard the Beatles, then we heard a Roger Miller song. They used to play instrumental tracks. Remember instrumental hits? Something like Classical Gas as I head toward Oregon and Mason Williams territory.
Right.
Something like that. Could you imagine something like that being played on the radio now?
No.
A guitar instrumental like that? Classical piece. It's crazy. So that was what I was exposed to, like, without even trying, you know. So that was just the way it was. So that's what I'm used to. It's all kind of – I like mixing it all together. And so that gives me – the community of musicians I'm in is fascinating because I know all these different people from these different styles.
I bet you know everybody. Last night I mentioned I just came back from Austin and I said I'd seen Alvin Crowe, and immediately you knew – him and had played with him and
well, I haven't played with him, but I was able to seek out, for instance, if I can seek out people that are connected with the musical heroes, is Sir Douglas Quintet, Doug Somm. All those musicians were there in Austin, and they knew I liked his music, and they got together with me to play. I remember Ernie Darawa, the bassist the drummer from Texas Tornadoes, and played a lot with Sir Doug ever since he was a teenager. He told me, I told my grandmother I was going to do a recording session with you. I told my mother, and she said, "How did you meet this guy?" And he said, "On the internet." And she said, "You be careful about those guys you meet on the internet."
Well, I think one of the things that's great about about your experience is it shows how musicians are really not these limited, you know, one-trick ponies. They generally like a lot of different things, and they generally want to play a lot of – and capable of playing a lot of different things. And they just – you know, if you give them the opportunity not to be restricted, they're going to go in whatever direction.
Well, it's nice to give – yeah, you never know what people are going to want to do or not want to do. But, yeah, so the process is really fun.
All right. Well, that's a good place for us to, I think, move on to. Maybe we have one more track to line up, and Ted will tell us what that is.
So we got a couple options. There's the Eugene Chadbourne collaboration with Camper Van Beethoven, Camper Van Chadbourne. Oh, we could play a track off that. There's the new record we could dip into.
What do you want to do, old or new?
Well, since you mentioned that other thing, why don't you play the Evil Filthy Preacher?
That was one of the things.
That never runs out of style.
That's going to take me back to whatever, 16 or 17 years old when that record came out. It was one of the first records I ever got. So
we had a couple of really good scandals in a row right around that time when I was writing that. Jim Backer and Tammy Faye Baker, that whole...
You're right. It never goes out of style.
And then Jerry Falwell. Yeah, it never goes out of style.
All right.
Okay, so I didn't have time to cue it, but we'll just jump right into what I think is the track.
All right. Well, thanks, Eugene, for coming. And you know, it's been a great opportunity to have you come and hear your music and get a chance to talk to you. And good luck in...
Thank you so much to both of you. Yeah. Thanks, Dave, for setting up the show.
Well, thank you, Ted.
And bringing Eugene here to campus.
Thank you. And here goes something.
All right. Is this it? Okay, and I'll bring the guys back because it's marked confusingly because there's all the liner notes are on one side.
Well, back in the day, the more confusing the record, the better, right?
Oh yeah. Well, I always liked putting out records that had absolutely no even mention of my name, and people would still know who it was. I think that, but that's funny. The track you put on, so we ended up at these sessions doing a version of this Pharoah Sanders. Creator has a master plan, Humala, one of those. It might be both of them together. The piano player was really very good at playing that style. And one of the record labels that was going to release that was like, that's not what we want at all. What do you think you're doing? They were very upset that we were... And I always thought, well, usually I have absolutely no idea about what's going to be a trend or whatever. But when you think about how many people have done cover versions of that song since then, like especially from soul and rap music, it's unbelievable. Yeah. So these people don't always know.
I think we got it.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Evil Filthy Preacher.
Have a safe trip. You too.
All right.
It's the end of
the last one.
Yeah. That's a nice ending there. Thank you, Bruce Ackley on soprano saxophone.
Very nice. Okay, now we should get something.
He was an evil, filthy preacher, pointing his finger at the sinners, and he wanted Roman soldiers to carry out his orders. He had a quiver in his voice when he said there'd be no choice. Those who bow and pray and send in all their cash won't feel the sting of his lash.
Hard-earned money from the faithful, stolen by a devil, living like a Roman emperor, not like a common man.
They believe in a god who gets to make love to sexy women in his hot tub. Money buys their silence, no one betrays. the evil, filthy preacher. He's a sinning man. He wants forgiveness again. I thank the Lord will give credit to the sinners who admit it, to the sinners who are proud of it.
He started talking loud, trying to stir up the crowd.
I've helped y'all, now you help me.
Find the road back to salvation. And they believed him once more. And the next chance he's with a whore, doing what them Roman soldiers do. A sin when done by me or you. He's a sinning man. He wants forgiveness again. I thank the Lord who give the credit to the sinners who admit it, to the sinners who are proud of it. Put it on the pulpit. I never meant it. God don't need no trash. He needs a president. Some say the bumper sticker. Looks like a swastika in the distance. When he's all alone. What sinful desires go through Pat Robertson's bones? The man I know is just another evil, filthy preacher. An evil, filthy preacher. He's a sinner, man. He wants forgiveness again and again. I thank the Lord will give the credit to the sinners who admit it, to the sinners who are proud of it. I thank the Lord will give the credit to the sinners who admit it, to the sinners who are proud of it.
Folks, this is Del McCurry of the Masters of Bluegrass, and you're listening to KCSB-FM in Santa Barbara.